come back to the sports review here on Planet FM. And I have our next guest, he is the voice of a generation of rugby followers. He's not only is he a fantastic broadcaster going back to the 70s, but he's been the voice for many years for all of us that love rugby. Please welcome to the show, Grant Nisbet. Grant, how are you going?
G'day, Emma. I'm well, mate. Looking forward to this.
Yeah, well. I suppose when we look back at 2011, going back to the beginning, because you were part of the initial TVNZ team that done the coverage here in 1987, a lot of people don't remember. It was an invitation-only tournament, so 16 teams were invited as part of that, so there was no qualifications, no rankings, nothing like that. So it really did have humble beginnings, didn't it, Grant?
Yeah, it did. I mean, there was a lot of reluctance on the part of particularly the Northern Hemisphere, I think, to actually go with the World Cup. They had their Five Nations at the time, and they thought that was probably as good as it would ever get. We certainly pushed a fair bit for a Rugby World Cup, and eventually we got it, and we were awarded it. And, you know, when you look back at some of those games back in 1987, there weren't very many spectators. I think of that opening game at Eden Park, where there was barely half full, I think. But it did gather a little momentum, and, of course, it was the start of great things.
It certainly was the start of great things, and I think really when the World Cup, from my perspective, as someone coming in, and you would have been when, obviously in 1995, when South Africa were to host it, and we had the whole Mandela effect on it, that's when we knew how big this tournament was going to be, and from the last World Cup in an amateur era going into the professional era.
Yeah, well, South Africa was unique in its own way because, of course, it was the first time they'd been involved. They weren't involved in 87 or 91 because they were still in isolation, if you like. So in 95, when they re-emerged and hosted, it really was quite a remarkable tournament. You remember that the All Blacks really were the dominant team throughout that tournament, but the final was a different story. And it really was quite something to have been at Ellis Park that day, even though we didn't win the game. The whole atmosphere, the whole Mandela effect, and the game itself, how it was won by drop kicks and all sorts of different aspects of it. And what I remember most, I think, was the absolute humility of the South African people. They didn't expect to win, but when they did win, obviously they celebrated, but they were pretty humble about it. And that's one thing that really has stuck in my memory.
Yeah, and it did change rugby because after that we went into a professional era. You moved from TVNZ to take up an opportunity at Sky TV in 1996, where you were part of probably some of the most historic parts of New Zealand rugby. The first All Blacks win in South Africa in South Africa ever in 1996, the match of the century 2000. And during your broadcasting time, every time there was a World Cup, it either went to TVNZ or TV3. And then 2011, you were back after an absence to broadcast a World Cup. You must have been quite excited about finally getting to call a World Cup again.
Yeah, look, it was pretty frustrating not being able to do several World Cups, particularly once the professional era kicked in, and rugby went to a different scale, really. So not to do it in 99, not to do it in 2003, and not to do it in 2007. And while the All Blacks underperformed at all of those tournaments, it was really disappointing not to be there. So, you know, there was a lot of expectation when we came to 2011. We hadn't won the Rugby World Cup since the first, so it was a 24-year gap. And through most of that time, we were regarded as the number one team in the world, but we just couldn't nail it when it really mattered. So there were huge expectations, obviously, on the All Blacks in 2011, because not only were they probably the best team going around, but also it was at home where we were under extreme scrutiny.
Yeah, and of course, as I said to Sir Graham Henry yesterday, when I had my chat with him, he actually, you know, the hardest thing is the pressure at home. Overall, the tournament, now, from my memories, it was a fantastic tournament. You know, what was your thoughts on the tournament in general? Just well ran, it was quite well ran.
Yes. Yeah, it was, for sure. I mean, we had a couple of pretty soft games to start us. I think we played Tonga and Japan, and it wasn't really until we got to France in our third game that we had a significant opposition, a team where you thought, well, maybe we could lose this. But we hammered them, absolutely hammered them. And then, of course, we played Canada just to complete our pool games. And then we're off into the quarterfinals, semifinals. But I think New Zealand embraced the Rugby World Cup back then. I think, you know, a lot of the teams, obviously, a lot of the cities that hosted were kind of neutral cities. And, you know, if it was, let's say it was Canada against Tonga, they embraced one team or the other, but still went along and had a look. I think overall it was a really, really successful tournament.
Yeah, and I would also say that, you know, there were some great highlights, like where we spoke off air, like the World Cup, really, like many World Cups, they don't go to prediction, especially that night at Eden Park when Ireland beat Australia. You were calling the match for Sky. That was one hell of a match and one hell of an atmosphere.
Yeah, it was, and it was an absolute upset that Ireland did it, of course, and what it effectively did, it put everybody on the other side of the draw. So I think we were kind of thinking we'd end up maybe playing Australia in the final. Well, because of the way Ireland played that particular night, we ended up having to play them in the semi-final. And you've got to remember, Australia were a very good team then. Just prior to the World Cup, we'd gone to Suncorp and we'd lost. And we had a full-strength team in. I mean, I know we lost in Port Elizabeth in South Africa, but we took a wee bit of a second-string team over, like Richie McCaw didn't go. But, you know, all the guns were there at Suncorp on, well, it was August the 27th, so it was only weeks before the World Cup kicked off. And so Australia, I think, generally went into the tournament regarded as our greatest opponent. And to lose to Ireland, as they did, was pretty significant because it threw the draw out something terrible, and we ended up having to play them in the semi-final.
Yeah, and of course there was a lot of pressure on that World Cup, and of course, looking back at it, the pressure on, you know, the All Blacks, and of course, when I looked at that World Cup before going into the knockout phases, like, New Zealand had looked like the form team going into the knockout stages. South Africa had really just scraped a one-point victory over Wales. Really were very, very lucky to beat Manu Samoa that night at Albany, a 40-man Manu Samoa. England looked pretty average. France, we just didn't know. We didn't know what they were doing. And Australia, well, their World Cup turned over when Ireland beat them. So I suppose when we look back at the group stages, it possibly, if we all looked at it, we probably were all betting an All Blacks, we're probably back in an All Blacks Australia final, but when that game changed it a bit, we didn't know who we were going to get. And of course, if you saw France before the knockout stages, Grant, they were pretty average.
They were pretty average. Like, we beat them 37-13, or 37-17, it might have been. And it was a fair old hiding. I'm pretty sure I actually got involved in that game, but France were average. That was also at Eden Park, and on that particular night we scored, what, 5 tries, they got a couple, and we were totally dominant. And you wouldn't have imagined at that stage that the French would come all the way through, but of course, you know, as they did in the very first World Cup, they seem to find their form as the tournament grows. And we found out twice subsequent to 1987 how good they can be in the knockout stages. They hadn't gone on to win the cup, but they managed to bowl us a couple of times, so we should have been very wary. The other factor, of course, was, and you can never overlook this, is the injuries that occur during a tournament. And you've got to remember that Dan Carter went down. He was obviously the original number 10. The other number 10 was Colin Slade. Now, he went down at one stage as well. And when the team was announced, there was no sign of Aaron Cruden or Stephen Donald, both of whom ended up playing significant parts in the latter stages of that tournament.
Well, yes. And of course, the old white bait got to 10. So when we look forward to some of the knockout games, like obviously there was a lot of intensity going into the Australia game where the All Blacks were just superb that night. Grant, Corey Jane under that high ball there was just brilliant. And I think what I saw from the All Blacks was a different type of play. Like usually in the past we've had big strong wingers, we had more slight wingers who were good athletically in the air, had a bit of pace, it didn't have to be big. So that to me really did change it. But getting to this final now, as a commentator, it can be the most, you and Grant Fox done that final for Sky Sport, it can be the most loneliest place in the world, and it, you know, your preparation before this final and that match, tell us the experiences from the voice of rugby in New Zealand.
Well, I mean, you have to treat these games, sure they're big games, but you have to treat them as just another game, really. And I felt for Grant Fox because, of course, he is an All Black. I think he played 46 test matches. And he lives and breathes the All Blacks. We all know he's a terrific player. And he has been involved in rugby most of his life. And so he had a real emotional connection to the final without any doubt whatsoever. Ian Smith was sidelined, of course, and Smithy was an international sportsman as well. But I think I really felt for Foxy on the night because there were times when it felt like we weren't going to do the job. And you've got to remember that it was 5-0 at half time after that Tony Woodcock try. Then the French hit back quite early in the second half when Dussatois scored his try, and that was converted, and then it was up to Stephen Donald. But at one point, we lost Foxy. He disappeared from the commentary box for about 10 minutes. He needed a toilet stop, and he just took the cans off and went. And I remember Ian Smith said to me later, he said, "What happened there?" I said, "No, Foxy just needed a toilet break, you know." And Smithy looked up and he could only see one head, and it was mine. And he kind of wondered whether Foxy might have sold out on the floor. But anyway, he eventually came back. But yeah, it was tough. And I think most people who had anything to do with that game, you know, I spoke to a lot of people who were watching it at home, and they said they went outside and they walked around and maybe had a cigarette or came back and sort of the old stick the head in the sand thing and hope that things are okay when you come back. But you can't do that when you're broadcasting, of course. So, look, we had to stick with it. I think you just had to be professional and try and divorce yourself from it. But it wasn't an easy task, I can tell you.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't have been. And of course, with Sir Graham Headley, he's actually admitted to me that he's never watched that game. And, you know, like, it can be, like, because you, and for you, you know, I was so impressed on how you kept your composure, and it was probably a different experience doing the next World Cup in 2015 for you, Grant.
Yeah, totally different. I mean, we were the playing through champions, so that brings with it a different sort of pressure, I suppose. But not being at home, it's not quite the same. You know, 2011... everybody was talking about it. The World Cup final in 2015 was in London, which is a huge city. Not everyone was talking about it. Not everyone was focused on it. And it was a terrific game. It was a totally different game to 2011. I mean, if you went back and reflected on the 2011 final, it was no great spectacle. It was, you know, it was hard. It was tough. It was, you know, it was confrontational and all the rest of it. Whereas you fast forward 4 years, there were some lovely tries scored in that final. Sure, there was a lot of tension involved, particularly when, I think it was Ben Smith, went to the bin for 10 minutes and Australia suddenly came back into it. But two entirely different games, but both equally as satisfying.
Yep, absolutely. Well, I have to say, Grant, I've really enjoyed this chat and the insight into the World Cup from a commentator's perspective. And I really hope that we can maybe have more chats on air in the future, Grant.
Yeah, look forward to it. Look forward to it. There's plenty of memories out there.
Oh, I tell you what, you've got a lot of good memories, and our listeners will really enjoy it. Will enjoy this, ladies and gentlemen. The voice of New Zealand rugby, Grant Nisbet. FM, and this is a special. It's remembering 2011. You know, Jock Hobbs and the team from the New Zealand Rugby Union went there in 2005 to Dublin, along with ex-Prime Minister Helen Clark, probably not favoured to win it, to win selection to host the 2011 World Cup, but we're granted that. During that time, they appointed a man who's a fantastic, not only a fantastic CEO, fantastic administrator, also a personal cricketing hero of mine, and also a very, very good bloke. Please welcome to the show, Martin Sneddon. Good afternoon, Martin. How are you?
Good. How can I follow on from that sort of introduction?
Yep. Yeah, well, I was just going to say that, obviously, well, I remember when you got them your 5-wicketer against the West Indies in 87, so I do remember that.
Only about 35 years ago, mate.
Yeah, well, it shows how old we both are, so, but we won't go to that. Getting back to when you got appointed to the job as the World Cup the CEO of the World Cup company, some of the pitfalls, obviously there was always the debate about the two stadiums, do we have Eden Park or do we build, or the proposed stadium in New Zealand that was, which local government wanted at the time on the waterfront. You also had to deal with a lot of other things like, so that was one thing. And then the second thing that really was the tough one would have been 2011, February the 22nd, in Christchurch as well. So just give us some of your thoughts on the initial teething issues you had coming into this World Cup.
I suppose the starting point is that when we won the event, there was a lot of scepticism that a country as small as New Zealand and geographically isolated could do a really good job of running such a major event. And so a lot of the early work that we did as an organisation was to try and build confidence amongst ourselves and amongst others in our ability to do that. But that meant sort of building a team from scratch, making sure that the sort of planning for this was well beyond anything I'd ever been involved in before. And as you've mentioned, sort of fronting up to some of the issues that have existed, some of them infrastructural, some of them financial, and just the sheer magnitude of trying to run 48, I think it was, test matches within a six-week period and making sure that New Zealanders backed it and that they were well attended and all of that. So there was just, it felt like there were issue after issue we had to deal with early. The Eden Park one was a biggie in the sense that we had promised the IRB that the venue for the final of the Rugby World Cup would have a capacity of 60,000 people. Well, Eden Park only held 48,000. And so the whole kerfuffle around how to upgrade it sort of got out of control a little bit. I think they ended up with a pretty good result, actually, myself, with still using Eden Park as opposed to a new stadium, and thereby, I think, making sure that we were going to have a stadium ready for the start of the tournament. But it was a bit unsettling for everyone, and so we sort of had to build confidence in the fact that Eden Park would be a good venue, which ultimately it was, because it ended up, because of Christchurch, ended up hosting 11 matches and had
Yeah, and of course, 60,000. Sorry, Martin, I'll continue on.
No, I was just saying that the 11 matches, I mean, I think we had about 6 sellouts and pretty good attendances at the other 5 matches. So it became a pretty special venue, really, in the end. But there was also Dunedin having a new stadium and upgrades elsewhere. And so it was as much as it was a sporting event, it was actually an infrastructural upgrade happening in various places around New Zealand as well that we had to keep a really close eye on, because we just couldn't afford to turn up for the start of the tournament and some of the stuff wasn't ready. So it was a bit stressful.
It certainly was, and of course the Christchurch decision, you know, the guys took it out of your hand, and of course, you know, you would have had a connection not only for your cricket career but with your time with New Zealand cricket down in Christchurch as well too.
Yeah, that was easily the saddest and hardest part of the whole event preparation, really. We had set Christchurch up to be a really strong focal point for the tournament. It was going to host 8 games, including a quarterfinals weekend on the Saturday and the Sunday, and all things going according to plan, the All Blacks would be involved in one of those. And you know, because of the success of the Crusaders and the backing of rugby within the Christchurch community at that stage, it sort of was going to be really special. But as you say, I mean, natural events took it out of our hands, and then having to deal with the sadness and the grief within Christchurch at the same time as we were trying to sell the story that this was an event for a stadium of 4 million people right across New Zealand. We had to work our way through that really carefully. Logistically, we had to transfer the matches elsewhere in New Zealand, and you couldn't send that from Christchurch to one other place. We had to distribute that around, which was challenging. we had to refund $28 million worth of tickets that had been sold at the time and start from scratch again. But none of that mattered in comparison to trying to deal with the people of Christchurch and make them feel part of the tournament, notwithstanding they were probably in the, you know, the hardest time of their lives, really. So that was a big focus once the earthquake happened. And I think we did quite a good job of that. And I thought that the people of Christchurch were remarkably generous in accepting that this huge event was happening all over New Zealand at a time they were under enormous stress.
Certainly was, and of course one of the things that I have to say was so innovative, the innovation around the Rugby World Cup, Martin, was you know, like you had your fan zones in several areas. You had your you know, in Auckland, for instance, we had the fans trail to Eden Park up Queen Street, up Green and Happy Road through Newton Gully to that. But there was a, you know, you could always tell with the volunteers in the uniform, and there were so many good volunteers that wanted to be part of it. And I think New Zealand, what they did, they really immersed themselves in it.
And that was a key strategy right from the start. I think when we started planning 4 years out, the biggest risk we identified was that the country, being as supportive of rugby as it is, would be obsessed with this being an opportunity for the All Blacks to win the Rugby World Cup after having been through four or five previous events where they'd failed. And for us, that was a huge risk because we had 20 teams competing in the tournament and we wanted to make sure that New Zealanders backed all 20 teams, not just one team. And so the mechanisms we used to try and make sure that happened was firstly to ensure that as many communities around New Zealand as possible were involved in the tournament directly, hosting teams or hosting matches. And then that for those people who weren't that interested in rugby, that the flavour was about communities having fun, showing off themselves and what they were good at, as opposed to it being overly rugby-centric. So what we had is a rolling festival, really, over the 45 days of the event, which went from the tip of the North Island down to the tip of the South Island, Stewart Island. And it was just magnificent, you know, just watching it sort of roll here and there and everyone just getting really wrapped up and making sure that their communities did a great job, not just for the people who were there, but the visitors, but also for themselves, just having fun. And it worked. And consequently, the risk of obsession with the All Blacks sort of fell away a bit, and people actually got right in behind a whole lot of the other teams. And we saw that in the stadia at times, where the atmosphere in some of the games, not involving the All Blacks at all, was just spectacular.
And I have to say one thing, I know you've always said that when Ireland beat Australia, that really turned the tournament on its head. And of course, one of the things I always remember about is when Ireland got knocked out, a lot of bar owners in Auckland were quite disappointed.
I think they'd had a pretty good time up until then, though. You're right, that game Australia-Ireland, which was only 1 week into the tournament, was a critical point where, in front of 60,000 people, I mean, it felt like you were in Lansdowne Road in Dublin. So many people were just there supporting the Irish, and they pulled off a real upset victory, which turned the tournament on its head, really, because we had sort of half expected that Australia would go down one side of the draw safely and reach the final, and the All Blacks would do the same on the other side, so it'd be a New Zealand-Australia final. Well, Ireland's win against Australia meant that suddenly Australia were on the outside of this draw, which meant that there was a little bit more risk around the All Blacks not making it through to the final because they'd come against the Aussies in the semi. But the Ireland was just a good example of New Zealanders getting behind all sorts of countries. You know, Tonga was, people took Tonga to their heart. The little teams that were placed in communities around New Zealand were supported enormously. Charlotte's, you know, that's one of my great memories of the tournament, is that we had the colours of the teams just everywhere. You know, there was the bunting of the tournament, there were the flags on cars, there was banners all over people's, you know, fences of their homes, and It was just a really joyous occasion.
It certainly was, Martin, and of course you think about it, you know, you have a look at it, this tournament, and then put New Zealand really on the map as a place for events, and, you know, like the nationalism in the country was fantastic at the time. I don't think we've seen nationalism probably like this since Team New Zealand won the America's Cup in 95, and probably going back to the Second World War. One of the things is like, I know that you were watching the final, I know that you were a New Zealander, but you possibly were thinking, I really want this to, we're at the last game, we really want this tournament to go off without a hitch.
I did have that hat on. To be honest, our organisation, which wasn't New Zealand Rugby, it was a hybrid of New Zealand Rugby and New Zealand Government, our primary focus throughout was on all the teams and all the matches, and the All Blacks were given no more priority in that planning than any of the other 19 teams, and that's the way it had to be. So I didn't really take a huge amount of notice of the All Blacks during the tournament. I love rugby and I wanted them to do well and reach the final, but that wasn't my priority. By the time we had safely got through and in particular navigated their way around Australia in the semi-final, then it was a pretty exciting final week, because we felt really confident in our preparations, and so the pressure felt, funnily enough, like it was dropping away. The people of New Zealand, I think, felt really satisfied that we'd put on a magnificent event, so the country's reputation had gone up and people felt good about themselves and about being New Zealanders. And so it was probably only in the last week that we settled back and concentrated a bit on the All Blacks and just sort of hoped that it would be their day. It was a pretty nerve-wracking final, not from an operational point of view, because we were really confident about that, but just because the match unexpectedly was so incredibly close. And, yeah, it was lovely that they just snuck across the line at the end, but there are a few grey hairs, I think, getting there.
And, of course, the legacy it leaves on New Zealand, let's go to such things as, Martin, you went on to be involved in the 2015 Cricket World Cup. Looking, as you know, we've got the Women's World Cup coming in 2023, which should be a big event. Do you believe that New Zealand now is in a position to maybe go and, like, take, for instance, we may never get the Olympics here, but could we co-host with Australia, say, a Men's Football World Cup?
Yeah, we could. Firstly, the capability around events in New Zealand is now fantastic, world class, and we've successfully hosted a series of world events since 2011 that just continually proves how good we are at running them. I don't think we realistically could think about an Olympics. But absolutely, for a number of years, I've been saying quite publicly at times that we should set ourselves the challenge of joining up with Australia and co-hosting the Football World Cup. That event, apart from being enormous, has been spread around various parts of the football world, but it hasn't been to Oceania. And, you know, I just think it could come here if we are prepared to put the hard work into selling that dream to FIFA and doing it hand in hand with Australia. And so the opportunity in a couple of years' time to host the FIFA Women's World Cup is, I think, is actually a really important part of that journey to securing the Men's Football World Cup. And so, and I don't have any doubt that we'll do it really well. And so one day I'd just love to see us hosting that Men's World Cup. I think it's possible. And in fact, in a funny sort of way, I think there's more chance of us getting that event than there is getting another Rugby World Cup. I think, unfortunately, on the rugby side of things, that money now is talking so much that there won't be an appetite to send that event our way, whereas I think in football they've already got so much money that...
Absolutely, Martin. Well, I have to say, Martin, I've really enjoyed this chat, and I have And, you know, I'm hoping that at some point down the track, once we're back to normality, that we can sit back and have a coffee at our local cafe. And also that I might get you to come on the show again, and we might just look to do a special series on hosting events and with your experience in the world as from that. So, Martin Steedham, thank you very much.
And thank you.
Obviously a very experienced sportsman. You know, he played rugby league for the Kangaroos for Australia. And he was a mature guy and respected by the rest of the All Black team. He was a member of the leadership group. We had seven guys, and over that period from 2008 to 2011, and he was one of those seven. And he was looked up to by the younger members of the team, and all members of the team, to be frank. So he was a huge asset.
Yeah, he certainly was, and of course he really gave that physicality as well too, Graham.
Oh yeah, no, he was a big man and always looked after himself, so he's always extremely fit and extremely strong. And he just added to the group through his experience, through his professionalism, through his example to others, players mentoring of younger players. He helped a lot of the younger players in the All Blacks during that four-year period leading up to 2011 Rugby World Cup. So he was a very special man and a special player. Now you can see what he's doing with the Reds, you know, that.
Yeah.
Australian Super Champions, and they're playing for Brad Thorne because he's that sort of person. Yeah, and he gives that bit of hard-nosed attitude. Some of the new players he did introduce into the cycle, like obviously Israel Dagg and Kieran Reid. Kieran Reid went on to be a future All Black captain. Israel Dagg very much ended up. He gave them that sort of unpredictability and that dynamism at fullback. I know that it would have been a very, very difficult choice with him and Mills Moliaina to pick between either of them for you, Graham.
Oh, yeah, that's a good problem to have, isn't it? Millsy played 100 games for the All Blacks. He got injured in the quarter-final of the Rugby World Cup in 2011, and Israel took over semi-final. Both quality players, quality people. But Millsy was a very much a senior player in that group, like with Brad Thorne, was a member of the leadership group. So he was another influential character. And I think he helped Israel develop as a player as well. So good competition, good support for each other. I think it still goes on today.
Yes, and of course, Graham, prior to the Rugby World Cup 2011, you had that cycle in there. And obviously, from an outsider looking in, Graham, I really bought that performance in France against France in 2009, where it was a 37-12 victory. Really, I think from then on, you can see it solidified the side. Like the introduction of newer players like the Corey James and the Kieran Reid came into it and became prominent within that side.
Yeah, that was the game in Marseille, correct?
Yeah, that's correct, Graham, yes.
Yeah, at the end of the tour. You have to help me here. You're always trying to develop a team through the years for the Rugby World Cup, and depending on when that is, you know, the 2009 was only 2 years away, and I think you're right. You know, I think that game gave us the springboard to go forward. And we were looking at different combinations and we did a lot of rotation in those days, which was frowned upon by the media and some of the public. It's common knowledge today. Everybody's doing rotation, so it was just part of what we tried to do to try and get greater competition and also to keep guys on edge and keep them fit and healthy. By playing every test match, they were blunted and didn't play that well, but when there was competition and they had rest every now and again, that brought the best out of them.
It certainly does, and of course, breeding competition brings the best out in any sporting discipline, Graham. So moving ahead to 2010, it was another good year for you, another rugby championship. So we went to 2011, we had the Tri Nations game and the Bettors Lake Cup games. Then we came to the 2011 World Cup selection. Were there any hard selections at the time that you just from memory, Graham, looking back, that you had to think twice about? Or
I'm sure, like every All Black team, there's huge competition, and there'll be some very unlucky players. I remember Ben Smith didn't make the 2011 Rugby World Cup team, and he'd played 2010. I think he toured Europe in 2010 at the end of the season. So he would have been one of those players, and the year later, in 2012, he became, I think, a permanent member of the side. So, and there's been some retirements as well, but there's always competition. There's always unlucky players. And he's just one example. Like Aaron Cruden didn't make that side. Aaron Cruden was very, very young. We probably made a mistake in only picking two fly halves, two first five eights for the 2011 Rugby World Cup team. And he came on as a replacement for Daniel Carter. So there's always going to be some disappointed players.
Yeah, and that comes with any selection. And of course, later on, Aaron Cruden was to join the squad as a replacement. So also, when it came down to that day, of course, the expectation when you play it at home
compares to possibly playing, say, overseas, and especially for the All Blacks, the pressure is always there, but at home it's essentially hard. What was your feelings going into it? Were you confident, or did you have some nervous trepidation heading into this?
There's always a bit of nerves in there, but I think, when you're coaching at that level, you're totally focused and you've got belief that the boys can do the business and the group can do the business, and we always had that belief. We probably, if you look back to 2007 and we got beaten by France in the quarterfinal, a lot of analysis went into why we got beaten. And you can make excuses, but at the end of the day, we just weren't strong enough mentally. So it was a difficult day at the office that day, and we found the officials very difficult. But, we should have been better than that, and we weren't. So the big learning, I think, was that we needed to improve our mental strength, our ability to handle pressure on the field, and that was a big part of going into 2011. The unexpected is going to happen, handle it, and that what came out of 2007. So the unexpected was the officials in that quarterfinal. The unexpected in 2011 was injury to Daniel Carter, injury to Richie McCaw, who played with a broken foot. And just overcoming those sort of things. So there's probably the two most substantial players in the side were both struggling, one out of the tournament, didn't play in the finals, obviously, in Daniel, and then Richie playing with a broken metatarsal, which was unbelievable. But obviously handicapped him. So they were the challenges of 2011, and we managed to get over that and win the tournament. So, and we had, where we didn't have much luck in 2007, we had a bit of a bounce of the ball in 2011. There's swings and roundabouts, but how we missed Carter and McCaw's influence was amazing for a guy playing with a broken foot.
Yeah, because when you look at that final, I don't think I've ever seen an all black right back to just, and of course you kept it a lot under wraps, and of course there was during the semi-finals, I believe you had Matt Todd on standby. Was that more just to deflect the media off Richie?
No, we were concerned about him, and we didn't know whether he was going to get through or not. Mm. And obviously, you have to have a contingency, and so we needed to have somebody standing by, and that was a clear and obvious thing to do.
Yeah. And of course, going back to Dan Carter, of course, he had a virtuoso performance against France. I felt, geez, he was just superb that day, as the All Blacks were against in that group match. But you had faith in Colin Slade to carry us forward in this journey.
Oh, for sure. He was selected in the 30. I think we only allowed to have 30 in those days in a rugby cup team. And Colin was selected as the second first five eight after Daniel. And the problem was that Colin got injured as well. So Daniel ripped the adductor tendon off the bone, kicking goals before the last round robin game in Wellington against Canada. And Colin obviously was selected to play as his replacement. In fact, Daniel was going to captain the side against Canada for the first time to captain the All Blacks for Daniel Carter, so that was hugely difficult and very sad for him, because he was probably the most influential rugby player with McCaw in the world, as we saw it. And he, as you say, he was superb against the French in the round robin. He's probably with 20-odd points to us, 25 points to us. Quality goal kicker, quality player, world's best number 10, and you lose him out of the tournament, that's a major challenge. So the unexpected had happened, and Colin stepped up. He did the same thing. He ripped the adductor against the Argentinians at Eden Park in the quarterfinal, and obviously
Aaron Cruden replaced Daniel, and then we had to find another replacement for Colin, and then Beaver came in, so Steve Donald was his replacement. So yeah, we're down to number four, and so those are pretty serious challenges.
And of course, you had the conversation I believe you had with Beaver as he was out white baiting. And I must ask you, did he bring, was the white bait up to the standard when he brought it up to join the squad?
Well, I couldn't get hold of him, and I said to Mills Mariaino, I said, I can't get hold of Beaver. And he said, look, I know a young lady who know exactly where he is. And about 3 months. 3 minutes later, Beaver rang me and I said, what are you doing? And he said, I'm white baiting, Ted. I said, how much you got? He said, I've got 6 kilos. I said, well, it's a shitload of white bait, Beaver. If you bring that to my hotel room in Auckland, you can play in the final of the Rugby World Cup. And that's exactly what happened.
And of course, when you think about it, come the man, come the moment. And you know, like poor old Stephen Donald had probably worn a bit of the public backlash after the defeat against the Wallabies in Hong Kong. But you know, it was great to see a guy get that chance. And you know, it's pure luck. But isn't it good to? His story was a fantastic story. In fact, you know, for Beaver now he's a star of radio. He's just about, he's an America's Cup expert. He's just about in everything you see here at the moment. And so his was a great story. But we go back to that final, and you know, I suppose, as a fan, we were nervous. As fans, we went in with a quiet confidence. But you know, like you as the coach would have had everything covered in that. But during that last 10 minutes, it must have been, you know, any coaching career, the most nerve wracking experience for you.
And I'm just going back to Beaver because I think it's important. You know, he is a fantastic person and a great team guy, and all the boys love him. And so for him to go from zero to hero in that second half of the final of the Rugby World Cup was fantastic. And as you say, you know, he's everywhere now. Like, he's written a book, there's been a movie about him. He'll probably be the next Prime Minister, I'd imagine. So that was fabulous. Fabulous for him, and he did the business. And you can't ask any more than that. As far as the final was concerned, yeah, that was my last test I coached, and it was the 140th. So it's a lot of test matches, but no doubt that second half of that final was demanding, to say the least. You know, it was. But I was so proud of Richie, how he led the team, and we had a number of replacements who came on and added to the ability to handle the pressure. Like Andrew Hall came on and gave his place, and Artie Williams came on and he added to the occasion, and changed at halfback, helped me there. Canterbury, Craig
Andy Ellis
is, thank you, senior moment.
No worries.
Andy Ellis was superb. So, you know, everybody added there a little bit. But I thought the way Richie handled that pressure and just kept the ball, the All Blacks kept the ball for a long, long time in that second half and killed the game. So, huge relief. Marvellous relief. Great feeling afterwards, just feeling of absolute peace. And you don't get that very often. And so after, you know, a long time, 12 years coaching international rugby, was a great way to finish. And just so proud of what the boys did.
Yeah, and you know, to win a Rugby World Cup is just a crowning achievement for you, Graham. And, you know, if you were on the tournament, it really was, you know, you obviously had your interest, but just the tournament itself, it really was a great time to be in New Zealand. It was a great time to be a New Zealander, and especially after that World Cup final.
Oh, for sure. sure, you know, you hear all the stories, but, you know, we're in a cocoon, really. We're in a bubble. But for modern term, you know, when you came in the Rugby World Cup, you live in hotels and you concentrate on what you need to do. But the rest of the country is loving what the Rugby World Cup and New Zealand grew as a nation and was hugely respected around the world for what they did in that Rugby World Cup. So New Zealand has added greatly to that occasion. And it was just a great way to finish. Thank goodness that we gave the French a hiding 7-6 in that final.
It was 8-7, actually, Graham. I have to question you on that. I apologize. Sorry about that.
Well, there you are, you see. So, you know, I've been at the matches setting in now. Now I'm 9-5, so it's I'm struggling a bit.
Well, I have to say... Yep, I have to say this chat's been really great, Graham. And it's good to look at the inside for you, and you know, like you, after you became Graham.
Sorry, I've lost you.
You know, remembering back to it, So you were knighted after this, Graham, and so when you look back on it, you know, it's like you're officially known as Ted, and you probably would come down as one of our most popular coaches. You know, like everybody enjoyed, you know, your good dry sense of humour, your dry wit, which added to what which we hadn't seen in a long time in New Zealand rugby because of. And, you know, on the behalf of New Zealand and on behalf of this radio show, I want to thank you for coming on this show because I think, you know, we could not have a World Cup show without you, Ted. I'm not going to call you Sir Graham because you might call me up on that. But it's just good to find out the stories and how much pressure you're under, and it just means it means so much for this country, and I think there'll be memories will live on again. Now I will ask you something in leaving. Would you do it again, that final?
Well, I've never watched the final. Obviously, that's how I got the result wrong. I've never watched the final since that day, Labour Weekend 2011. So I think it's the anniversary this weekend, the 10th anniversary. I think I just feel very grateful to get the opportunity to coach the All Black rugby team. You know, it's just an amazing opportunity. I feel very grateful, and to coach with Wayne Smith and Steve Hansen was a privilege as well. And we had a very good management team, as I keep on saying. You know, Richie was superb in the final, playing with a broken foot. And we overcame adversity because we had some major injuries during that tournament and still managed to do the job. And so I think that was a sign of the team growing from 2007 when we didn't have the mental toughness to see through a difficult quarterfinal, and I think we showed some mental toughness to get through the final in 2011. So, as I say, very grateful for that opportunity and very grateful to be able to stay and live in this country afterwards.
Absolutely, Graham. Well, thank you so much. I really enjoyed our chat today, and I hope that you enjoy your Labour weekend and enjoy your Labour Day, and try and get out for a bit of fresh air, and stay safe, and all the best for the rest of the year for you, sir.
Thank you, and all the best to the listeners, and stay safe.
Bye. Thank you very much.
Thanks everyone for listening to the show today. This one was a special one, and I want to thank Paul and Michelle and our production team. Wonderful, wonderful people. And I want to thank you, the listeners, and hope everyone's safe over lockdown, and I hope that brings a bit of a smile to people's face. And we'll see you next week.